I'm standing on the dockside wall,
sailing on the evening tide,
awaiting for the skipper's call.
Time ashore, bright hours ashore, time ashore is over.
And Sally's watching as I go,
sailing on the evening tide,
tear-filled eyes, two kids in tow.
Time ashore, bright hours ashore, time ashore is over.
The year is 1631, and the unassuming, sleepy fishing village of Baltimore has settled for a night of rest. This is no ordinary night, however, and what happens on this balmy summer's eve is to change the history of Baltimore forever. On the night of June 20th, 1631, the town of Baltimore was besieged and ransacked by a group of mysterious men from foreign lands. Over 100 people would be taken from their beds and forced onto ships that sailed across the Irish Sea and the Mediterranean. Their sea journey would pass more than 1,000 sea miles before sighting land. This country was Algeria. But what is the connection between the sleepy village of Baltimore and the faraway lands of Algiers? Who were these people that ransacked the village of Baltimore with terror and fear? What were their motives? And what happened to the individuals that were taken? What happened to those who were left behind? We meet the present-day locals of Baltimore, and they help us to understand how important this night back in 1631 was for the town. This connection of past and present comes together beautifully as locals give commemoration and celebration to the day the foreigners came. They share with us their story of the sacking of Baltimore. The story of white slavery in Europe is one that is seldom told, and one that has somehow managed to fall between the cracks of history. Algiers, the capital of Algeria, is at the core of what happened in Baltimore in 1631. Algiers at this time was under Turkish Ottoman control as the Ottoman Empire continued its vast expansion and piracy, and privateers sailed and plundered the Mediterranean coastal towns. But what was Algiers like in 1631? I spoke with Des Aiken, author of The Stolen Village.
Algiers was quite a small place. It often amazed people how small it was when you think of how much power it wielded in Europe at the time, because it held a lot of the Western European states to ransom, quite literally. It was quite a small city. It was about 100,000 people. But the interesting thing about it was that about a quarter of the population of Algiers were made up of slaves from all over the world. At that time, 1631, there was about 500 English and Irish slaves, and that number grew to about 4,000. So there's a large number of slaves there. That's what their economy subsisted on. It was also, strangely enough, quite a pleasant place to live. At the time when people in London were emptying their bedpans into the street, people in Algiers had running water. They had fresh running water. They had sewage systems. It was kept very clean and healthy. All the streets were kept regularly swept, and they had orchards everywhere. That was one of the things that struck visitors to the city, how rich in fruits and vegetables. So it was quite a nice place, unless, of course, you were a slave. For people who ran the city and who existed on this economy, it was a very pleasant place to live. The history of it was strange in that it used to be under Spanish rule about 120 years earlier, and it was seized back by pirates, corsairs, and they began to rule Algiers instead of the Spanish, and they kept it for the Turkish Ottoman Empire. The Sultan of the Turkish Ottoman Empire from Constantinople sent his militia over there, the famous Janissaries. They were a sort of handpicked, originally Christian militia, and they were to safeguard the interests of the Sultan against these pirates. So from then on, de facto, they had a dual government. made up of the pirates, the corsairs, and on the one hand, and the Janissary militia on the other. The militia, over the years, gradually went native. They intermarried, and so they became a sort of law unto themselves, quite apart from the ruling body in Constantinople. So the two of them together, in this sort of tense relationship, ruled Algiers, and they kept on raiding and getting more and more slaves. And the Sultan of the Turkish Ottoman Empire was very happy about this, because he could say, on the one hand, if Western nations approached him and said, "Why are you taking all our slaves?" He could say, "I can't control these people. They're outside my remit. You know, it's they're not properly ruled by me. They're semi-detached." But he would quite happily take all the profits. So there's this very, very strange setup, which means that every time a slaving mission set off, the crew was usually made up, practically always made up, of pirates and of the Janissary militia. So they would set sail together, with each of them protecting their own interests.
Memoirs from an Icelandic slave diary from Pastor Alvar Eielsson, who was a Lutheran clergyman from the Westman Islands in Iceland, gives the following description of Algiers.
"The land yields two crops yearly, and all the fruits of the earth flourish there. The grass is never cut, and sheep and cattle remain odors all year round, since there is no winter. These pagan people reap all the benefits in this life. The town is very narrow at the upper and near the mountain, and very long and wide at the sea. Their marketplace is a square built of bricks, and the ground is paved with stones, which I understand is washed every day as much as the houses, sometimes as much as three times a day. This marketplace is next to where the local king has his seat."
Morat Rees was the captain that led the Janissaries from Algiers to Ireland. But who was he? Des Aiken tells us.
Strangely enough, he wasn't a Turkish nobleman, or he wasn't a North African sheikh. He was a very sedate, middle-class Dutchman from Haarlem in Holland. And he began his career as one of these privateers, licensed pirates, licensed and allowed to hunt his country's enemies. And he did very well at that and discovered he just had a talent for it. But then he began to go further south and realised that he could make a lot more money by allying himself with the Algiers pirate economy, the corsairs there. So he converted to Islam, changed his name from his original Dutch name of Jan Janssen, which is probably the most boring name you can have, to Morat Rees. And he had a string of aliases as well, described him as very mannered, very diplomatic, a chameleon, in that he would go to people of whatever country and make them believe that he was really their country's best friend, and he was just doing this out of necessity, but really what he wanted to do was help the English or the Dutch or Stilly, whoever. But he was a very charming and an educated man. There was one very sort of pathetic scene. After he married the member of the royal family in Morocco, it didn't bother him that he already had a wife and family back home in Holland. So at one stage, he returned home under the terms of some truce. He landed on the dock and appeared in all his Moorish finery to talk to the local officials there. And his wife and children came down to the pier and begged him tearfully to come back to them. But he refused, turned his back and went back to his new wife and his new home in the sun.
The pirates continued to plot and plan their next journey.
"As you all know, I am Captain Morad. We here in Algiers must seek out new lands and further lands. Who knows what treasures lie beyond our imaginings? We limit but ourselves. We dare to take what is not ours, and yet we are graciously rewarded each time with lavish gifts of gold, wondrous foods, and working bodies. Clearly, God appeases our actions and provides us with protection on the ferocious seas. It is for these reasons that I ask all of you, if anyone has navigated outside of these familiar waters, to stand up and offer their assistance in our next voyage, and your bravery will be rewarded tenfold with heavenly treasures."
"I put myself forward, Captain. I am Vice Admiral Matthias van Bostel Oosterlink, and I bear myself capable of performing such incredible feats as you describe. And it would not only be a joy, but an honour to serve under you. I have vast experience of the seas unknown. I have been trained to read the stars and to read their latitude. I can not only take you forward, but also beyond your wildest expectations. I have many charts from previous voyages that will lead us to a safe voyage. I also have a good eye for picking slaves.
Very good, Ustalink. You shall be my second in command. From Iceland to Ireland, let us roll the waves once more. Let us seek out further fortunes. Let us travel to Ireland.
Aye, aye, Captain!
There were sort of very few ways that people could make money in Algiers, but this was one way that they could succeed spectacularly. If you got a good slaving mission, you'd invested a few quid into that, you would be very well rewarded.
Welcome to all new crew members, fair mateys. Let us drink to celebrate the coming together of our future destiny, and let us embrace the elements of the sea in good faith. We shall set sail in the morn.
Hooray, up she rises, hooray.
In 1631, Ireland was ruled by Gaelic tribes, and rivalry between the tribes was rampant. Baltimore had become a prime location for fishing boats to land their catches of pilchards. In fact, the town's wealth was based on following the silvery, shiny shoals of herring in their migration routes off the Munster coastline. It became a thriving industry dominated by Fionn O'Driscoll of the O'Driscoll clan, and for 400 years the O'Driscoll clan reigned in Dúnasháid Castle. I went to visit the castle and spoke with Bernie McCarthy, who has spent a number of years bringing the castle ruins back to life. Bernie fills us in on all things O'Driscoll, the historical connections with the castle, and what happens today in Baltimore in memory of the sacking.
Well, this was O'Driscoll territory way back. They claim that it goes back to about 2,000 years. But in the 13th century, the Normans came in and took this area. They took a lot of the land all along the coast and built these small stone castles on them. And they were here for about 100 years. But after that, in the beginning of the 1300s, the O'Driscolls and the McCarthys, who were the other local clans, had a battle with the Normans and ousted them and took their lands back, which now had a castle on it. So they came back and remained in this castle for about 300 years, right up to the 1600s, which was the Battle of Kinsale time. And they operated very lucratively out of this area. They were fishermen and they traded very much with Europe. They imported wines and all sorts of luxury goods, olives from Italy, wine from Bordeaux and Spain, wow. Spices from the Far East. They had a very nice lifestyle. They also exported fish and hides and meat. And all the foreign boats that came into the harbour had to pay taxes to them, so they were a very wealthy clan. Until the Battle of Kinsale time, when all Irish history, of course, changed.
What is the connection then between the castle and the pirate festival that's celebrated today in Baltimore?
Well, there was a history of piracy all the way through, really, in this area, probably because of the geographical proximity to the sea, obviously, and so the southern coastline, and all the islands and inlets and coves. It was very conducive to piracy. The O'Driscolls themselves were pirates. I said they were fishermen and traders, but they also took goods, let's say, off boats if they wanted to, so they acted in a piratical way. After their demise, shall we say, there was an English colony here. Thomas Crook was the leader of the English colony, and they were pirates also. They fled from the south of England, where the piracy laws in the 1600s were getting much more rigid, and they came over here because they had more freedom from the king.
What is the theme of the festival?
Baltimore has such a piratical history. We thought that it would be something to commemorate the tragic event. Really, it was a tragic event, so it's a commemoration of those people who were taken, and to try and remember that event and that part in Baltimore's history. Children, of course, love the fun and games attached to it, but there's also a serious element because it was a very sad story and a very tragic event in Baltimore's history.
a feud breaks out between the O'Driscolls of Baltimore and Piers Dobin from Waterford. And what happens next changes the future of the town forever.
The leader at the time of the 1600s was Sir Fineann O'Driscoll. And he sided with the English in most things. But when it came to the time of the Spanish invasion, he changed his mind and went over to support the Spanish and the dissident Irish who wanted to get the English out of Ireland. And as a result, when they were defeated and the Spanish were driven home, he was pardoned, very lucky to be pardoned, because most people who sided were either executed or had their lands removed from them. But he managed to retain his lands, but he was completely broke. So when a group of English people came and offered to rent the town of Baltimore, the village of Baltimore, he agreed and he signed a document that would lease it to them for 21 years. And these people were strange in that they, you know, we tend to think of English people as being Anglican, purely Anglican, and therefore sort of part of the suppressing force in Ireland. But in fact, these particular English settlers were Puritans, and they came from a subgroup of people who didn't like the Anglican Church and the fact that it had become so high church and was very close to Catholicism in so many ways. They wanted to get, they followed the teachings of Calvin, and they wanted to get their religion back to its purest state again. They were actually dissenters, and they were fleeing from religious persecution back in England. First of all, they indulged in quite a bit of piracy in their own right. They helped to supply the pirates who came to the southwest of Ireland, people who had been put out of work by James I's decision to scrap privateering. So you get this huge influx of pirates, and people in Baltimore, the English settlers, did a lot of supplying, and they facilitated the pirates in a lot of ways. They helped them to maintain their ships, to sell them supplies, gave them cattle, that sort of thing. But as time went on, the pirates drifted away, and the people in Baltimore reverted to what became their main financial activity, which was fishing. They would catch shoals of pilchards, which were very plentiful at that time. They would salt them and send them all over the world, even to as far as the New World and France, Spain, places like that. It was a hugely lucrative industry, and that's what most of the people who were captured from Baltimore would have been involved in.
I am Fineann O'Driscoll, head of the O'Driscoll clan of Munster. I will let no other clan take precedence over my expanse of industries and lands.
I am Piers Dobbin from Waterford, and I declare war on all things but the O'Driscoll name. For you have not only deceived us, but stolen wine from us, and in the cause of justice I will march 400 men into your lands to burn and cause grave carnage upon your name.
You may burn and carnage, but no other tribe will see my turf, I will ensure of that. I would prefer that of distant foreigners to bear rein than that of local hogs from the Mucksavage hinterland of Waterford. I have had enough of this fighting, and I hereby sell the town of Baltimore to Thomas Cook for a fine sum of £2,000.
The town of Baltimore quickly fills up with English settlers, eager to practice their religion in a free and peaceful land, and life in the town of Baltimore remains calm for a period of time. Or that is, at least until the eve of June 20th, 1631. One could say, perhaps, it was the calm before the storm. I spoke with the O'Driscoll chieftain about the clan gathering that takes place each year in Baltimore.
Who started the O'Driscoll clan gathering?
It started, I think it was an initiative in the village itself. So this year is the 30th anniversary of the modern clan gathering. I believe that there was a clan gathering back in the 60s at some time, but I think it started in 86, and I guess it were almost like a tourism initiative on behalf of the village to get, you know, people, obviously with O'Driscoll ancestry, coming to you know where it all started, I suppose.
What's the role of the chieftain?
The chieftain, it's a 2-year appointment. So historically, the chieftain would have come from the village or one of the islands. So back in 2005, they kind of took a different turn, and they started appointing the chieftain from within the clan members who actually come to the clan gathering. So the first non-local chieftain was a guy called Dave Driscoll, who was knocking around, and from the UK. So it's a symbolic appointment. chieftain does have to help with the organising of the clan gathering, hence that's one of the reasons I've come over early this time, just to help organise things. For example, we have a talk in the castle on the Friday of every clan gathering. Bernie, who lives in the castle, she agreed to do it for me, so that's one thing I had to organise then. Again, we open the clan gathering officially on the Friday evening, so normally we open it amongst ourselves.
How do you elect the chieftain?
There's kind of a bit of a natural order to it now, because we do it from within the clan gathering. I think it's people who've supported the clan gathering over the years. And again, it's not just that. I mean, the chieftains who've gone before me, it's not just a case of turn up for the clan gathering. They'll be here at different times of the year. You know, for example, I came over in February for a week. Although we have the chieftains like a kind of two-year appointment, Marion's in the background as a kind of permanent chieftain, really. You know, so last year, for example, everyone said, "What do you think the new chieftain will be?" So I'm having to lie through my teeth. So I don't know. You know, there's a few who've been coming to the clan gathering almost as long as I have now. So they'd be kind of next in line to get the chain of office. It's a lovely, lovely thing.
So what's the schedule then?
We actually start on the Thursday. Traditionally, it's just the Algiers around the corner. We start with the traditional music session, so we entitle that greeting of the clan, so people come in for the first time, we have music on. But last year, and again this year, Dominic Casey up at Casey's Hotel, who's got the microbrewery there, we were starting there with a little tour around his microbrewery, then we'll be in the Algiers for a music session. On the Friday, we're going to take a boat trip, and then Friday then 7 o'clock, so that'll be the afternoon of the boat trip, 7 o'clock, and Bernie McCarthy in the castle's going to do a talk about the history of the castle. Obviously she's wrote a couple of books on the castle and the pirates activity in and around Baltimore. Then we'll have the grand opening Saturday. We'll take a boat trip out to Cape Clear, and Dr. Langford, Eamon Langford, who runs the museum out there, he's organised, he started it 4 or 5 years ago, and it's like an O'Driscoll remembrance ceremony. So for example, there'll be a guy from America coming this time with a candle, and someone from Australia will represent Australia, and they'll bring candles basically to remember various ancestors and loved ones, you know, who kind of left these shores, you know, often under obviously awful circumstances.
I continue my visit to the Pirate Festival and join a walking tour of the harbour with Connie Kelleher. Connie is an underwater archaeologist and researches piratical activity in Baltimore. Many children join the tour.
This is where the original settlement of Baltimore was. It was up here, up on the hill. So before the castle or anything was built, this is where the original people of Baltimore lived. And then when the pirates came here, they came here at the same time as the English, what we call planters or settlers, and they set up and established their settlement, and that kind of slowly took over. So a lot of what went on down here then, the people integrated with that, with those, and there's archaeological sites around here. There's what we call a fish palace just down over here behind the house. It's only holes in the rock now that's left, but that was for processing and curing fish. And that was an industry that was here run by the English, and the pirates again came in, because the pirates at the time, they were here for about 20 years, and they decided when they wanted to be pirates and when they wanted to be settlers. So they did both, and they settled. In the winters they'd go pirating, and in the summer they might work here as fishermen or shoemakers or labourers or cobblers. So they used to do both. So you can imagine that where you are now, that it was a real vibrant, heaving kind of a place, with loads of people around the place and loads of things going on. And this whole area would have been covered in boats. Now this area is very shallow, the tide is in at the moment, but when it dries out, it goes right out almost to the point. So it's no good for big boats. But what it is good for is for cleaning the hulls of boats. Pirates had smaller boats, so they could come in and maneuver themselves around, sail around the islands, whereas the Navy, the Royal Navy at the time, that was based in Kinsale, couldn't, because their boats were too big, so the pirates could get away a lot easier. So that's why they couldn't be beaten, and that's why they were pardoned eventually, because the government didn't have enough men or ships to actually beat the pirates, so they pardoned them, and most of the pirates settled at that stage.
Why do pirates live on boats? Why don't they just live on land? Could save
them. They do live on land too when they're not in their boats, but they need their boats for pirating. And they live on land. What's the? We usually call them smugglers when they're on land, as opposed to pirates.
But X marks the spot.
X marks the spot of buried treasure.
Yeah, but if it's buried treasure, why don't they just stay on land?
Connie brings us down to the exact spot in Baltimore Harbor where the pirates attacked the villagers on that night in June.
This is also the area in 1631. You've heard about the pirate raid on Baltimore, have you? Famous pirate raid by the Algerines, and this is where they came in. So there's a small cove down farther where they came in, brought their boats around from the main harbour mouth and moored outside, rowed in, and they came up here and they attacked the local inhabitants here. And they took away about 100 people, 109 I think it was, as slaves. And that wasn't the earlier piracy that was here with the English. They had all stopped piracy at this stage. This was kind of a new piracy that was based in North Africa, and they came all the way from North Africa, and they were dealing in slavery at that stage. So rather than coming in and trading things like pepper and guns or shells or gold and silver, they were interested in people, which wasn't very nice. So they would take the people and they'd take them to North Africa and they'd be sold there for slaves. They attacked. They took the people and they herded up in, they were going to make their way up to the main settlement up where we were by the castle, but somebody raised the alarm and they didn't go into the main settlement. Instead they went back into their boats and they went out the small harbour and they got away. So that's the pirate raid on Baltimore. So you're in the right area for what happened in 1631.
Pirate corsairs on the seas, pirate corsairs on the seas, heading straight for Ireland. So beat the drum and sound the horn, ring the bell that trounce the warm, shield the people from the storm, they'll all be gone by morning.
In 1631, there was an attack, which is called the Sack of Baltimore. There was an attack by Barbary corsairs from Algiers, the Algiers area. They came in just on one occasion and landed only in Baltimore. It's the only time they landed on Irish soil. So they landed and took a lot of the townspeople off to Africa and sold them as slaves. So that was a very traumatic and tragic event for Baltimore, which had been a very wealthy and large and thriving port up to that time. But of course, the people who remained were scared it would happen again. So a lot of them moved inland away from the coast, and it really was the end of the wealthy era for Baltimore.
What happened was that at some stage, probably around May, Morat, the pirate captain, set sail from Algiers in two serious warships with about a total of 36 guns, 280 musketeers. They included the pirates who had converted to Islam. They were known as renegados and the Janissaries.
Back in the land where pashas and sultans reign their mighty empires, the hot red sun beats down on Captain Morat and his ferocious associates. The pirates plot and prepare at the mouth of the harbour in Algiers for their deadly attack on Baltimore. They pack their ships with food provisions and slaves. They are meticulous in their attention to detail, for they know that being prepared is half the battle.
How many ships shall we prepare to take to Hibernia? Not only that, Captain, but how many men shall I need to source for this expedition? And who shall we take? How many seasoned slaves shall we need?
Two ships at best, Dusselin. 200 men needed in total for both ships. Start gathering from the markets and the town square a crowd that bear interest in such a journey. Entice them with notions of lavish booty 45% of stock to be divided amongst the crew, with officers, pilot, master gunner, and surgeon receiving 3 parts, and cannoneers thus 2 parts.
The men work frantically in preparing for the voyage. It was by no means an easy feat. Preparation was key in facilitating a smooth journey and was also good for morale on board if the ship was organised and efficient. A number of weeks pass and finally the crew agree that they are ready to set sail and conquer the unknown in the name of seeking fortune. It is the beginning of summer and the season of looting, early May to be precise, and it would take the pirates over 4 weeks to reach the Irish shores. But first, they must leave the shores of Algiers.
And provisions, Captain? What foods shall prove worthy of such a lengthy and arduous journey?
You must go to the market and order live chickens from Musafa so we can have fresh cackled fruit on board. Order salted fish and beef and pickled vegetables. Ensure the barrelman packs the food well into the wooden barrels so as to keep as fresh as the sea air itself.
Such a voyage was indeed celebrated by all, for the profits of slavery went straight back into the city's coffers and therefore rewarded all citizens. It is a time for celebration that is deeply engulfed in rituals and ceremonious habits to ward off all evils and bring fortunes home. It is a day of hope and a day of festivities for the people of Algiers. Even the Pasha visits the crew before they depart on their journey to Ireland.
Why, Captain, I do believe the Pasha himself is over yonder. He wants to bestow good luck upon us.
Captain Mullad and Admiral Oosterlink, you give me great pleasure in honouring you and your crew with words of protection and salam alaikum. May the mother and father of the seas protect you, your vessel and your crew, and may you return with vast chests of treasures and booty.
Such a fine crowd hath come to wish us farewell at the port. It is a time of ceremony and festivity for all of Algiers.
The pirates preferred ships of oar-powered galleys, rowed by slaves, and when the wind picked up, a large lateen sail could be hoisted. The oars were long and slender and moved magnificently in unison, slicing through the choppy seas of the Mediterranean. One must remember, though, that the movement of such vessels and the power behind the oar is that of man, that of muscle, that of slave. These ships had guns at the bow, but nothing was quite as fierce as the pirates themselves, who could swarm and overthrow the top deck of a foreign vessel in minutes.
Please ensure the slaves load the cargo correctly onto the deck and stern.
Aye, aye, Captain. I have the men working in good order. Come on, lads. How's about an old sea shanty as we load and prepare the galley?
Aye, aye, Captain.
Pirate corsairs on the seas, on the seas, on the seas. Pirate corsairs on the seas, heading straight for Ireland. So beat the drum and sound the horn, ring the bell that trumps to warn. Shield the people from the storm, they'll all be gone by morning.
Back in Baltimore, the villagers prepared to go to chapel. This was a normal day like any other. Like so many other normal days, nothing strange, nothing startling, nothing surreal. Calm and unassuming. These villagers did not know that this would be their last visit to their church, their last time together as a community, their last time together as a family. Their fates would come crashing down in a world of sheer barbaric terror.
Hurry up, boys, or you'll be late for chapel. Get up and get washed and come break the fast while it's still warm, for your mother and father will be displeased if shown to be tardy on the Sabbath in front of thy neighbours. I won't take any of your tongue and cheek on such a day as the Sabbath. Now hop to it, or there shan't be anything to break the fast with. Shall you be wearing your lilac shawl and hat today, my lady, or the blue?
I shall wear the blue. And please will you ensure the shoes of Mr. Gunter are shined in time for church?
I will do.
And what are we breaking the fast with this morn?
Salted fish from John Ryder's catch not 2 days ago. And bread that I made fresh from the wheat that the O'Malleys have been growing.
Very good. William, I wonder if Stephen Pierce and his wife will be at church today. I would like to invite them to our house for luncheon next week. That way you and Stephen could talk about expanding the business.
Gunter's family was just one family that was torn apart the night the pirates raided Baltimore. Gunter and his 6 sons and his wife would be dragged from their beds and frog-marched onto the pirate boats. The corsairs left Algiers in high spirits and rolled the waves of the ocean time and time again. The oars hit the choppy waters in perfect unison. The weather was in their favour and left opportunity for high speed and for sail with cloth. The two ships had now gathered momentum and seized other vessels along route. One of these seized vessels belonged to John Hackett. They hopped on board and quizzed and threatened the fishermen. For they know not where they are, the fisherman from Waterford, John Hackett, negotiates his freedom in exchange for navigational aid.
That looks some sort of fishing boat. Let us take direction closer to land and closer to that sailboat. Perhaps we can extract information of where the treasures lie on this cretinous isle.
Aye, aye, Captain. You heard the Captain. Let's get a sea shanty going to get some rhythm and power.
Aye, aye, Captain!
What shall we do with the drunken sailor?
What shall we do with the drunken sailor?
What shall we do with the drunken sailor?
Her eye in the morning. Hooray, up she rises. Hooray, up she rises. Hooray, up she rises. Her eye in the morning.
Put him in a longboat till he's sober.
Put him in a longboat till he's sober.
Put him in a longboat till he's sober.
Her eye in the morning.
Give him a dose of salt and water.
Give him a dose of salt and water.
Give him a dose of salt and water.
Her eye in the morning.
Shave his belly with a rusty razor.
Shave his belly with a rusty razor.
Shave his belly with a rusty razor.
Her eye in the morning.
Hit him on the head with a bottle of porter.
Hit him on the head with a bottle of porter.
Hit him on the head with a bottle of porter.
Her eye in the morning.
John Hackett from Waterford, the man who piloted them, said, "No, you don't want to go there because there's too many of the King's Navy. You're going to get into trouble there. I'll take you to a place where it's unguarded and where you can get plenty of slaves."
The slaves pushed on through the commands that were hurled at them, and tensions mounted as they each knew they would be attacking unknown lands, which almost always carried a certain element of risk. But the risk always outweighed the benefit, with promises of loot and fortune.
How do you think we fare in terms of the journey thus far, Captain?
Ah, matey, the gulls and gannets circling our heads above, land must surely be close on the horizon.
I think I see land now, Captain. Look, everyone! We have arrived. That be the lands of Hibernia yonder. Keep moving those oar slaves, for no one wants to get tied to the mast now, do they? Or even worse, keel-hauled under the boat. Come on, work those arms.
Aye, aye, Captain!
When they arrived late on the night of Sunday the 19th, they hit the two ships just round there, behind that inlet, a place called the Eastern Hole. And by this time it was dark, and they managed to hide their ships without anybody seeing them. They put cloth around the paddles of their oars to make sure that they weren't going to make any sound and it would dull the splash. They fanned out around the cove. There were about 200 fighting men there, so the people of Baltimore didn't stand a chance.
The corsairs creep into Baltimore Harbour at midnight, and they begin a legacy of terror and despair for the people of Baltimore.
Raise the new flags, fair mateys. Approach is nay. We won't want to raise suspicion.
You heard the captain. Now move, you swags, before I have your guts for garters.
Aye, 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 captain!
An eerie silence oozes its way through the muddy, padded streets while the pirates prepare to launch a vicious assault on the sleeping village.
Fear not, my boys. The gods have favored us thus far with weather, and will continue to do so, for the winds have foretold us of our succession. Prepare to conquer. Prepare to pillage. Prepare to gorge and feast. Prepare to have your fill, men. Prepare to kill.
And with that, a ferocious attack commenced. All the pirates began chanting, shouting, screaming, clapping, and banging through the streets, ransacking everything in sight.
Oarsmen, yield! Prepare to moor the anchor. Avast!
Aye, Captain. Anchor over.
Master Gunner, prepare cannons for fire. All crew, prepare weapons for attack and strike!
One by one, 108 men, women and children were loaded onto the human-powered galley ship.
What happened was, first of all, the pirates stoved in all the doors with crowbars, and then they thrust burning torches into the thatched roofs of the houses. So within moments, the houses, each of them, simultaneously were set ablaze. And we just can't imagine what it must have been like for the people who were living in those houses. They sort of emerged, with their eyes streaming, coughing, spluttering with the smoke, and they were confronted by people just out of their worst nightmares, because they would see the pirates who were sort of cursing and swearing and threatening them, and there was the Turkish warriors who would have made a really frightening sight in their own right. They were wearing bright red tunics, they had plumed caps, cowled cloaks, and they were waving these vicious scimitars that was their distinctive fighting weapon, and they were swishing the air with that. But the interesting thing was that they very rarely touched human flesh with these swords, because their aim was not to kill people, their aim was to capture as many live, healthy humans for sale in the slave market. So what two men did put up resistance, and they were hacked down brutally and killed on the spot. And up the anchor and sailed off again, and this time they didn't stop to attack any other ships, because they didn't want to run the risk of losing any of their valuable cargo. They sailed right back to Algiers and landed them. The journey must have been absolutely horrendous, because the sailing ships were never a pleasant thing to sail in, even at the best of times for the crew. But when you think of all those women and children herded together in the bowels of this boat, and think of the sea motion, and think of all the human needs that they had, and it must have been absolutely horrendous. And also the ship was infested with lice, with rats, anything you can think of was there. So it must have been horrendous. So it's a miracle in itself that they managed to arrive at Algiers without losing any lives. They actually, all of the people who'd been taken that night arrived and were tallied in Algiers harbour after a journey of something like 38 days.
A naval vessel in Kinsale was roused to intercept their trail, but long before they got to sea, they were halfway to Gibraltar.
Pirate corsairs on the seas, on the seas, on the seas. Pirate corsairs on the seas, heading away from Ireland. So beat the drum and sound the horn, ring the bell, the troops to war. people from the storm. They'll all be gone by morning.
They'd got quite a large hall, 109 people first of all, but the demographics were absolutely amazing, though they had, most of them were children who were regarded as sort of one of the great investments in the slave trade. You could buy a child and double your money when they grew to adulthood a few years later.
Oh, they came for the women, the children. From the warm coast of Algiers, like vultures they came. Right on a riptide they came, and Baltimore village was ended.
Baltimore village was ended.
They took 34 women and 24 men, with their 55 children, never families again. 6 weeks in the hold on the terrible sea. They were landed white slaves to the port of Algiers.
Dear Lord, thy will be done. Here on this hell on earth, daylight will come. Dear Lord, thy kingdom come. In our pain and our suffering, judgment be done. And Baltimore village was ended. Baltimore village was ended.
Can you imagine the fear and the pain? The heartbreak of lovers, of mothers, of men. Can you imagine to be captured and chained and sold to a whoring slaver?
And Baltimore village was ended. Baltimore village was ended.
Can you imagine the grief and despair? Condemned to this bondage forever. Can you believe it could happen again? Can you believe it still happened?
And Baltimore village was ended.
For in man's degradation of his fellow man, in the grasp of the cursed abuser, the young, the naive, and the vulnerable pay. Fall to the winner, the loser.
And Baltimore village was ended. Baltimore village was ended.
All of Gunter's family were thrust onto the galley ships that sailed into the night, leaving Baltimore ablaze. Their fates, unknown to all, except for the scoundrelly pirates that besieged their beloved little fishing village. The able-bodied captives are put to work immediately rowing. The pirates are, of course, delighted and sing and chant and praise Allah for their fortunes. Who knows what was going through the minds of these 108 captives as they sailed the Irish Sea, the Atlantic, and then into the Mediterranean, before arriving in the hot African continent and the port of Algiers in 1631.
First of all, they were brought ashore. The English consul came down and took a tally of how many they were. Then they were paraded around the town. This always happened. There's no distinctive particular record of this happening in the case of Baltimore, but in every other case, they were paraded around town where all the townspeople came out and cheered to see just how successful this saving mission had been. It was sort of a major festivity in the town. There would be guns fired, there would be festivals. Everybody would go into celebration mode when a slaving ship arrived with a big cargo of humans. So they're taken right around the town, which must have been pretty horrendous for the slaves because they'd been holed up in the ship for so long, and also because the sights and sounds that they saw were so absolutely foreign to them. These were people who'd probably never been outside their own parish. So they'd be seeing, you know, the vendors with their donkeys. It's a real multinational melting pot of nations. And it was said that when people first emerged from the slaving ships and were paraded around, that some of them had been dropped dead of terror. I imagine it could have been a heart attack or something like that, but do you imagine just how traumatic it must have been for them? After that, the next stage was to go to the Pasha's palace. Now, the Pasha was the governor of Algiers, and he was entitled to 1/8 of all the slaves as of right. That was his, he took his first pick of them, and naturally he would take the most beautiful women, the most marketable slaves. So he took his share of them, and then after that, they would be taken back down again into the town to the notorious Bedistan slave market, and there they were sold on the open market.
The African continent, so mysterious and foreign in so many ways.
The men were sold just exactly as you would see cattle sold in a Midlands cattle mart, except with less regard for their welfare. They were under the blazing sun, they were made to trot around, they were put through their paces, they were poked and prodded with sticks, they were made to jump up into the air. They had people opening their mouths and looking at their teeth just to see if they were healthy. The auctioneer would be shouting all this time, "Look what a strong man this is, he's going to give you many, many years of work, what am I bid for this man?" And the bidding would go up and up, and eventually each person would be sold. The women were sold with slightly more decorum. They weren't put into the open market out in the street. They were put into an enclosed sales room where they were viewed and bought either by syndicates or by individuals. But still, the buyers had a right to examine them physically, and it must have been pretty humiliating for the women to have to go through that. The boys were in a particular class. They had their head shaved except for a long lock of hair that signified that they were Christians. They would be taken into a household. The aim was to help them to convert to Islam, and some of them agreed to it, some of them didn't. In many cases they were treated quite kindly as household servants. If they agreed to convert to Islam, there was a huge they brought great honour to their household. There was a huge ceremony for their conversion. They were taken around the town, they were dressed up in finery, taken around the town. And although they still technically remained slaves after converting, it was regarded as very bad form to keep someone as a slave. The younger women, sadly, were, most of them would have ended up as concubines, because pale-skinned Northern European women were regarded as very, very exotic in Algiers, and they were very much in demand, so they would have fetched very high prices. I speculate in the book, although it's not specifically recorded, that some of them would have ended up being taken to Constantinople to the Sultan's Grand Seraglio, because the Pasha of Algiers always had to give a certain proportion of the slaves that he took, which were the best to start with, and he had to send the best of those to the Sultan in Constantinople. The main thing they were looking for from everybody was a ransom. So it was only for rich families that they were able to achieve this. As a result of that, rich people often tried to hide their identities to try and stop a ransom being set impossibly high. So they would change clothes with their servants, they would pretend that they were humble labourers. But the Algerians, of course, were wise to that, and they had a lot of techniques to sort one out from the other. For example, they would look at their hands to see if they were calloused from hard work or if they were soft from never having done a hard day's work in their lives. They would examine their ears and check if they had earring holes in them. A lot of the men in Baltimore would have spent their lives rowing as part of the fishing industry. They were pretty good at that sort of thing. They would have been naturals for the state galleys. I imagine a few of them would have ended up as galley slaves. And everyone has the same short word to describe life on the galley slaves. It was just hell, sheer hell. People were worked until they dropped and then thrown over the side. They just kept replenishing them as they died. Food would be thrust into their mouths as they were rowing, so they wouldn't miss a single beat of the oar. While the this was happening, overseers were going up and down in the central gangway with pointed sticks and whips, and they would just lash out indiscriminately at all of the people on either side, so that they would never have a moment to rest. They were always being poked, they were always being whipped.
What happened to the town of Baltimore after the raid?
They didn't know that whether this was just an isolated raid or whether that this would be happening on a regular basis, which it did in other parts of the world. This was a whole new phenomenon, so a lot of them just left and they went. They became refugees. They just headed off on the road with their few belongings, and they went a bit further up the river and ended up in Skibbereen. And they were mainly responsible for the founding of Skibbereen. That's, so they were made up of people who'd gone away from Baltimore there. But it declined over the years, and after about another 100 years or so, it was regarded as just a poor little village with very little going for it. And eventually that turned around and it became quite a prosperous place, but for a couple of centuries afterwards it never recovered from that from that terrible blow that was dealt by the Algerian corsairs.
They moved inland along the Island River up to Skibbereen. Skibbereen was a tiny village at the time. Baltimore was a big town, and it went the other way. Baltimore declined and Skibbereen grew into the market town that it is now. And Baltimore died for a couple of hundred years. It was a very, very small place with no trade in it really. But it's now picking up again in the last century, more for the sea activities and tourism.
We know we have a good tally of the numbers who were taken from Baltimore. We have a good tally of them when they arrived there. We know that one woman was ransomed very soon afterwards. We know that 3 years afterwards, the ransoms were set at £100 each, that 40 of them had already either died or converted to Islam. They didn't distinguish between the two. And then we know that 15 years afterwards, when the English government finally got around to ransoming them in bulk, all the English captives in Algiers, only two people from Baltimore took up the offer to come home. One was a woman called Joan Broadbrook, who had been abducted with her two children, torn away from her husband, and she was pregnant at the time. So she obviously had her baby in Algiers. We don't know what happened to the baby. We know how much she was sold for on the slave market. She was sold for £32, which is the price roughly of 8 oxen back home. And then another woman was called Ellen Hawkins from Baltimore. We don't know anything about her. She wasn't named in the list of people who were taken, so she could easily have been one of the servants who were unnamed in that. So it's strange to think that that so few people took up this offer to go back home again to be ransomed. And there are all sorts of theories being put forward. I speculate that it might have been a case of Stockholm syndrome, this sort of psychological quirk that makes people identify with their captors when they feel that they've been let down by their government back home. And also the other thing is that they could have, a lot of them would have converted to Islam. They couldn't have gone back home again. They certainly couldn't have been ransomed. And others would have married, and they didn't want to leave their new husbands, wives, children. They just decided to stay. But the most convincing thing that I can think of is just demographics. You've got 50 of the 100 odd people who were taken from Baltimore were children. So even today, in the best of times, if you take a child of 7 and raise them in Australia or America, and you say, after 15 years, would you like to go home to Ireland? They would say, I don't know anything about Ireland, that's not my home.
Today in Baltimore, the children scream with delight as they celebrate and dress up as pirates for the Baltimore Pirate Festival that commemorates the landing of the Algerian pirates.
The end of this Baltimore story is strange. If you dare, you could try to explain it. When called to their freedom after 14 years there, all but one chose to remain.
All but one chose to remain. Dear Lord, thy will be done here on this hell on earth. Daylight will come. Dear Lord, thy kingdom come. In our pain and our suffering, judgment be done. Oh, they came for the women, the children, the men.
from the warm coast of Algiers, like vultures they came. In the calm of the night, on a riptide they came. And Baltimore Village was ended.
Baltimore Village was ended.
Funded by the Broadcasting Authority of Ireland with the television licence fee.